I think we've got a Q&A session now. Panha Vyakarana. Here we go. Question time. The one thing I learned when I was, because I teach in the Sri Lankan communities very often in Sydney, and one of the things that I learned when teaching the Sri Lankan communities is it's sometimes very, very difficult to get them to start talking and asking questions. Almost as difficult as it is to get them to stop once they get started. What is meditation? Can you be more specific? That's a very general question. That's not an ignorant point of view. That's an inquiring point of view. And that's always the path to wisdom, so you don't need to apologize for that. Yeah. So what is meditation? Meditation is training the mind. Yeah. And especially meditation is a way of training the mind which is characterized by a number of things. First of all is that we have we set aside a certain time and place for meditation. So it's a distinct period of things that you're doing, okay? That's one thing. Second thing is that we have a subject of meditation or a theme of meditation. In the last guided meditation we did mindfulness of breathing. Yeah? And so these subjects or themes are things which are there to support the meditation. Right? So that's what we're doing when we're sitting and practicing. And meditation is also defined by its outcomes. What are we trying to achieve through the meditation? And so the outcome of meditation, broadly speaking, is peace of mind and the wisdom that comes from that peace of mind. Yeah? So to sum all that up and put that together, meditation is a formal practice of spiritual development using particular approaches and themes to training the mind, leading towards peace and wisdom. Okay? Is that good enough? Okay.
That's embarrassing. Daily practice of meditation is something we do together, and I find that hugely enriching, and it does help with all sorts of things. But one of the challenges is that step where the regular meditation moves into a more mindful way of being, and the challenge I have is what are some good tools to remind myself of how to remain mindful during the day. I find it. I mean, I even use I use an iPhone app occasionally. That just gives me a bell randomly during the day that helps me kind of think, oh, it's time to be mindful. But so often I find myself caught up in the world and I'm running along in the world and I forget to be, come back to a single thing, whether it be breath or whatever it is, that gives me that peace and so it's that difficulty of bringing it into daily life. Do you have any help
okay,
with that?
Okay. Okay, well, I think many of us, or most of us, have experienced that when we practice on retreat, even a short retreat like this weekend, we can find some depth of peace that is quite special and we feel is quite precious. And one of the things that happens then is as soon as you have that experience of peace, the next thing you do is to start thinking, how am I going to keep this? What am I going to do when I go home that I can keep on practicing and I can keep on meditating and deepen this? Yeah? And so as soon as you've done that, of course, you've lost that peace. Yeah? Then it's gone away already. That's how quickly it happens. Yeah? There's a very highly apocryphal story of when the Buddha and Mara were standing together having a chat, and they were watching somebody walking along the road doing walking meditation. And that person stopped, bent down to the ground and picked something up. And Mara said, "What did he pick up?" And the Buddha said, "He picked up a piece of the truth." And Mara smiled. And the Buddha said, Why are you smiling, Mara?" He said, "Oh, well, give him just a minute, he'll make a doctrine out of it." So this is what happens when we have that experience, yeah, in meditation. A little bit of peace, a little bit of truth. The very next thing that happens, doesn't take long. Just one moment. And we start building our ideas around it, building our plans, building our expectations. Yeah? And so what was a fresh and unique and unrepeatable experience becomes something which we've wrapped up in our concepts and our expectations. Yeah? So the answer is, how do you practice mindfulness in your daily life? You can't. You all know that. You've all tried and you've failed. Right? Is there a single person here who can tell me that they've gone home after a retreat, tried to be mindful and succeeded? Is anybody here? No. So the Buddha said, "I only ask you to do what is possible." Right? If it was not possible, I would not ask you to do it. Yeah? So why do we keep giving ourselves impossible tasks and then beating ourselves up because we can't achieve them? The Buddha didn't do that. Okay? So this is why the Buddha gave us the Eightfold Path. Because wherever we are, there are some aspects of that Eightfold Path that we can do. We can try to practice right view. Yeah, by reading suttas, listening to Dhamma talks, discussing Dhamma, reflecting, thinking about Dhamma. Yeah, you can do that wherever you are. You can try to practice right intention. Okay, not being too greedy, not having cruel thoughts, trying to be kinder, trying to let go. Yeah, all of the factors in the right intention. Yeah, we can do that wherever we are. Right speech. Yeah, if you're in the family, at school, at workplace, right speech is one of the most important. Yeah, if you can do right speech. I mean, you know, you think just in terms of your workplace and your job and your career. How can you be successful at your career if you can't have right speech? Yeah, if you're always going to be nasty and yelling at people and lying and so on, no one's going to like you, no one's going to trust you. Right? So right speech is very important. Yeah? Right action, again, keeping our precepts, we can do right livelihood. Again, this is specifically what we're supposed to be practicing. If you go to work, you're not practicing right mindfulness, you're practicing right livelihood. Yeah? So your focus should be on how can I make this job as helpful as possible? How can I benefit as many people as possible through this job? Even if it's doing something simple, if you're working at a noodle stall, then you think my right livelihood is to make the best noodles that I can. Yeah? To be as polite to people as who come into me as I possibly can. Whatever work you're doing, that's your job then. Yeah? These are all the things which the Buddha's given us to practice in building the Eightfold Path. Every factor of the Eightfold Path is equally important. Right? There's not one that's more important than the other. Right? So then, then the advanced stage of practicing the Eightfold Path is the right last three. Right? The Samadhi section. Yeah? Right effort, right mindfulness, right Samadhi. That's what we try to perfect when we meditate, when we come along to a meditation retreat, and so on. These are the advanced practices. These are the ones which are hard to do, even when all the conditions are supporting you perfectly. Right? So even when we come here for this weekend, we don't have any pressures, we don't have any expectations, we're just here to meditate. It's still hard to be mindful of everything that we do. But at least we can try. We can have some success. We can get some idea of what that's about. Yeah. So we shouldn't take that experience and then go back and think, you know, how do I apply that when I'm doing something which is much more simple? Yeah. Just like if you've learnt to play Bach on your guitar, then you don't think when you're playing 12-bar blues, how can I introduce Bach into my 12-bar blues? You don't do that. 12-bar blues is one thing, Bach is another thing, and you can enjoy both of them for what they are. Yeah. Yeah. So that's much easier now. I've given you all permission. You don't have to be mindful. Actually, when I say don't have to be mindful, that's not quite correct. What it is, it's actually the concept that the Buddha used, and the word the Buddha used more than mindfulness, more than sati in that context, was the word sampajanya. And sampajanya is very similar in meaning to sati, mindfulness, but it has a slightly different nuance. But what sampajanya means is more like contextual awareness of what you're doing. Okay? So for example, when you're on retreat, you know, you're like, you walk and you pick up your foot and you put it down and you concentrate on every movement and so on. But if you're crossing a road in the busy streets in Colombo, is that what you do? No. Well, you can, but you will be put on the fast track to the heaven realms very, very quickly. Right? You have to have a contextual awareness. You look at the traffic, you understand what people movement around you is doing, and you walk quickly across the road. Yeah? So that's sampajanya, and it's a different kind of awareness which is suitable for different kinds of contexts. Please say again to the microphone so everyone can hear.
Would that be connected, what you said, with the difference between let it go and whatever?
Difference between letting go and whatever? Okay, maybe. I think where you're getting to that word in English, we have two words. We have disinterested and uninterested, right? Which is almost the same thing, but actually quite different. And you can understand the difference of that between that if you're thinking about a court case, for example, right? Now, you want the judge in the court case to be disinterested, but not uninterested. Right? If they're uninterested, then they're bored and they're falling asleep and they're not paying attention. Right? But if they're disinterested, that means they're not favouring and opposing, right? They're not taking sides. Yeah? So this is an idea of what we call in Buddhism equanimity. Okay? Actually, equanimity is, you know, like you said, that attitude of like whatever is like not caring. Yeah? Whereas equanimity is actually, it's not a very good translation of the Pali word upekkha. The Pali word upekkha literally means, upa means close, and pekkha means to watch. Yeah. So upekkha literally means to watch closely. Yeah. So it doesn't mean I'm not caring about it. It means I'm watching closely, but without interfering. Right? And the simile the Buddha gives is of smelting gold. And when you've got a pot of gold and you're melting it down and purifying it, sometimes you need to heat up the flames, sometimes you need to cool it down, sometimes you need to skim off the impurities from the surface of it, and sometimes everything is going right and you just need to watch over it, upekkha. Yeah? So you're not doing anything, but you're ready to do something if it needs to be. Yeah? So you're taking a great care about it, but you're not interfering. So this is upekkha. Yeah.
So where justice will fit in there?
Sorry?
Where in that explanation justice will fit in?
Justice? Mm-hmm. Where does justice fit in? Mm-hmm. Where does justice fit in? Well, you know, in Buddhism, the idea of justice is not nearly as big a concept as the idea of forgiveness. Yeah? So from a Buddhist sense of the most developed notion of justice is what we find in the what we call the Vinaya, is the code of discipline for the monks and nuns, because you have to understand, of course, the Buddha didn't sort of lay down legal codes for society, but he did for his own communities, and from that we get quite a good idea of how the Buddha would have approached these ideas of justice and punishment and things like that. So what we find in the Vinaya, the code of conduct for monks and nuns, is that it's very, very big on forgiveness and very, very small on punishment. Yeah? And there are some kinds of discipline and punishment for almost everything. You know, like we always talk about how the monks have so many rules and the nuns have so many rules and oh, it seems like such a hassle. But actually almost all those rules are very minor, and they can be cleared just by confessing them. right? So it's not like it's a black and white, something's forbidden or whatever. But if you try to keep the rules, and if you can't, then you confess it, and then it's okay. And we do this in the monk sangha. We do this all the time. So there are a few of the more serious ones which do have some kind of punishment. Usually it's something like you lose some seniority, or maybe you're given some extra chores or something like that. So there's no kind of flogging or chopping off people's hands or anything like that, but it's just something to remind you and to help. So there's not this idea of justice in that kind of way, that sometimes justice is more like vengeance, you know, where you need to make sure they pay for what they did. Nothing like that. All it is about trying to help people. And one of the basic, most important notions of justice in Buddhism, in modern legal systems, we have the idea of innocent until proven guilty, right? And Buddha already had that long time ago, but even to a much greater degree. And not only are you innocent until proven guilty, but in almost all cases, you can't be found guilty unless you actually confess. Yeah? So it's very, and when you do confess, then it's up to you to ask. If there's any punishment or any rehabilitation that's needed, you have to ask for that. It's not something that's imposed on you. Yeah? And so you have to say to the Sangha, I've committed this offence, I've done this which is wrong, may the Sangha please help me and rehabilitate me so that I can make amends for what I've done wrong. Yeah. Yeah. So again, so this that idea of like equanimity, it doesn't mean that you just not care what people are doing, right? You care for each other, and but there's also a great sense of trust that people have to make their own decisions. It's not our job to control people, to say, you know, you have to do this and you can't do that. And sometimes it's, you know, funny when I'm a monk, people have this strange idea that my job is to tell people what to do. I don't know. Why should I tell you what to do? I don't know what you should do. My job isn't to tell you what to do. And people say to me, oh, can I do this or can I do that? I say, well, sure, do what you like. It's not my job to say what you can do or can't do, or what you should do or shouldn't do, but my job is just to say, well, what's the Dhamma? And to try to reflect, get people to reflect on what the consequences of their actions are. There's a great example of this, one of my favourite little suttas and teachings of the Buddha. It's a very simple one, but the Buddha was walking for alms round, and he came across a group of boys who had pulled a crab out of a pond and were tormenting it and pulling the legs off this crab. Now, what do you do to that, right? Do you yell at them? You naughty boys, you shouldn't do that. That's cruel, that's nasty. Yeah? Do you give them some punishment? What do you do? Well, the Buddha comes along and he says, boys, what are you doing? And they say, we're pulling the legs off this crab. And the Buddha said, "He said, boys, do you feel pain?" They say, yes. He said, do you like it when you feel pain? They said, no. If somebody was to pull your limbs off, would you like that? And they said, no. They say, well, do you think this crab also feels pain? They said, well, yeah, probably. Do you think that crab likes it if we pull its legs off? No, I don't think so. Well, do you think it's a good idea for you to pull the legs off the crab? They said, no, not really. Yeah. So he's not there to tell them what to do. He's not there to say this is right and this is wrong. Yeah? They already know what's right and what's wrong. Ah, this is the trick. They already know. But the Buddha's job is to draw out that wisdom, to make them reflect on it, to make them understand the consequences of their actions so that they can improve in the beginning. And isn't that such a much more powerful way of doing it? If you go along and you tell the boys, don't do that, that's naughty, they'll stop doing it. And as soon as you turn your back, they'll start again. Right? Now, if you get people to understand, this is something that leads to suffering, then through their own wisdom, they'll learn to stop. This is something that happens to me when I'm in Australia. I use this teaching quite a lot because people come to me with their kids and they say, you know, please teach our children the Dhamma. You know, it's so hard to teach them what Buddhism is. And I say to the kids, you know, I'll use some example like that. I say, you know, is it right to kill or wrong to kill? They say, it's wrong to kill. Why is it wrong to kill? Because they hurt. And I go ask them all these questions. And then I say to the parents, you see, they already understand the Dhamma. What do you want me to do? Yeah. In Western philosophy, they call this a Socratic method, or because it was associated with Socrates, the great Greek philosopher. He used a very similar approach of questioning, but of course, like so many things, we find the Buddha was doing it just as well as Socrates was. Okay, next question.
Inasmuch as you said, sir, that the difficulty in crossing the road in a busy street and adopting mindfulness, would you think or would you agree that in a modern materialistic commercial world such as we live in, practicing Buddhism, the tenets of Buddhism, would be more for the layman, would be more for the bhikkhu than for the layman? Or in other words, it becomes more and more difficult in reality for the layman to practice the tenets. Isn't that true?
Struggle. It sounds like an excuse to me, I don't know. Wherever you are, you can choose. You can practice. Yeah? That's why you have the Eightfold Path. So of course, yes, you know, the Buddha said, okay, you know, if you want to really live your life fully according to the Dhamma, then that's what he set up the Sangha for, right? So he gave that opportunity for men and women who want to give up everything and go and practice, and that's there. But the Buddha never went around telling people you have to ordain. Right? There's not a single place in the suttas where the Buddha tells somebody you should ordain. Doesn't happen. Right? The Buddha teaches the Dhamma and then people come and say, I want to come and practice. Or if they want to practice in their lay life, then the Buddha will teach them for where they're practicing their lay life. It's entirely their choice. The only thing is that you have to understand that if you choose to practice in a particular context, that will have its own advantages and disadvantages. Yeah? And so sometimes the things you have to do when you're a monk, you know, some people spend ages trying to learn how to put their robes on. And they're like, oh, if only I could be a lay person, then I could just put on jeans and a t-shirt and I could just go and meditate and it'd be so much easier, right? So wherever you are, you know, that's a silly example, but there are plenty of things in the monastic life which also can be distracting or disturbing or time-wasting or whatever. It's very easy to do that, yeah? So there's no kind of magic trick. And there are also equally, there's plenty of great practitioners in the lay life who manage to practice right livelihood, to help their families and support their families and practice and support the Dhamma in many wonderful ways. So I don't think I don't think that it's not something that there's an absolute. It's something about you have to answer for yourself which one's the right way to practice. The only thing is, once you're in that situation, what's the best thing you can do here? Yeah.
So now, by the same token, now, with regards to justice, if you cannot impose punishment, would there not be an increasing perpetration of bad acts in society? Where does this come in? How do we manage this? Passing death sentence on an accused, right? From the viewpoint of a Buddhist.
Yeah.
If the Attorney General is a Buddhist and if he doesn't want to sign the papers because he's a Buddhist, is that right?
Sorry, I didn't catch that last sentence.
If the Attorney General of a country,
yeah,
of Sri Lanka, let's say, if he was a Buddhist,
yeah,
and he, simply from a Buddhist point of view, he doesn't want to sign the papers for the execution of a criminal,
yeah,
of an absolute dastardly criminal,
yeah,
how would we take that into... In the context of Buddhist pragmatism?
Sure. I mean, abolishing the death penalty is a basic criteria for any kind of humane treatment of criminals. And as with so many other things, was pioneered by Buddhism. King Ashoka was the first king recorded in history to abolish capital punishment. This was something which there was much discussion about in scholarly spheres because it revolved around the interpretation of certain obscure terms in the Pali, but that discussion was resolved about 10 or 15 years ago, maybe 20 years ago now, by K.R. Norman, the great English linguist, who showed once and for all that King Ashoka did abolish capital punishment. So, as with so often, the precedents are there, but in Buddhist countries we often don't live up to that. all of the modern studies that I've read on this show that, that capital punishment is completely ineffective as a deterrent, and the basic purpose of capital punishment is to get a sense of vengeance and a sense of getting your own back at people. It doesn't work in terms of actually stopping crime. And it's fairly obvious that you can see that in places like America, where there's a very high crime rate, highest incarceration rate of just about any country in the world, lots of capital punishment, as compared to, say, Europe, which culturally in other ways is quite similar levels of development and so on, and yet very much lower incarceration rates and hardly any, I don't think there's any capital punishment in the European countries, certainly much rarer. And now the EU countries, this is actually very interesting what's happening, because the chemicals that the Americans are using to kill people with are mostly sourced from the EU. And the chemical companies are now refusing to supply them. Yeah? So this has been going on for the last year or two. So now that the Americans are having more and more and more prisoners who literally they can't kill because they don't have the chemicals to do it. And they're trying to have to figure out how we're going to kill all these people. So this is, I think, quite interesting. From a Buddhist point of view, the bigger question then is how do we handle that? How do we handle justice and so on from a Buddhist point of view? Well, from a Buddhist point of view, the basic principle is non-harming. Okay, so we should avoid harming any criminal, but we also have a responsibility to protect society, because obviously the reason why is that someone's a criminal is because their acts are harming other people's, right? So we do need to act in a way that's going to prevent that criminal from causing harm to others. Sometimes that might mean putting them in jail, and there are plenty of models of jailing people which work in a humane and very effective way. It doesn't have to be cruel and harsh. And again, many examples, if you look at, a Norwegian jail system and other places where they've developed systems where things can be very, what looks like very, very lax in many ways, and yet it actually is successful in terms of rehabilitating people, turning them away from a life of crime, and lowering the crime rate in society as a whole. So yes, it has to be some degree of protection, but that protection shouldn't be punishment. You don't put somebody in jail to punish them. You put them in jail because their actions might be harmful to somebody else. And if you feel that you can let them out of jail without them being harmful, then I think you should do that. And if there's something else that they can do to give back to society, maybe by doing some work or something like that, then I think that's a better way of dealing with that rather than putting too many people in jail. Yeah, so that to me, that would be really a last resort.
I know that the Buddha ordained his own son, Rahula, okay, when he was really young. And I think King Suddhodana got very upset about that and yes, made a request that you should ask the parents or something. So I'm asking whether it's really a rule to get the permission of your parents to be ordained.
Uh-huh.
Or like, are you gonna like, or is like, if they say no, then yeah, is it a sin to go against them, their wishes?
Okay, it's quite an interesting question. As you said, the was one of the many cases. First thing to notice with that is that the Buddha, to start with, the Buddha just said, okay, Rahula wants to ordain, and said, gave him the going forth, right? So as with so many things, the Buddha didn't pretend to sort everything out firsthand, right? He just went along and did things, and then sometimes there would be problems and say, okay, we can change them. So this is very, very important to remember with when we're looking at especially the Vinaya, the code of conduct for bhikkhus and bhikkhunis. The Vinaya is as far as you could imagine from being a rigid and inflexible system. In fact, completely the opposite. The Vinaya is a record of the Buddha's flexible responses to particular situations and particular places and time. Yeah? And this is just one example of something we see constantly through the Vinaya. So the Buddha's responding to that. Okay, Rahula wants to ordain, fine, we do that. King Suddhodana is very upset, and he comes to the Buddha. Again, he comes with a reasonable request, yeah? And he says, love for the, what is it, love for your children cuts through your skin and having cut through the skin, it cuts through the inner skin, and having cut through the inner skin, it cuts through the flesh, and having cut through the flesh, it cuts through your bones, and having cut through your bones, it settles in your marrow and it stays there. Yeah? And so there's a very powerful image that he uses to express his sorrow for losing his grandson. So the Buddha didn't dismiss him. He didn't say, I know best. He didn't say, you know, come on, you look after your kingdom and I'll look after my Sangha, all right, just forget about it. No, he listened carefully and he would respond to that. So then he made the rule and said that if you want to go forth, then you should ask permission from your parents, right? Now, question which comes up is, to whom is that rule applied? Okay, because in the context, actually it's just Rahulu who's a young boy. And it makes perfect sense that a young child should have to ask permission from their parents before they ordain. Is that something which is meant to apply to adults as well? Right? I mean, how old do you have to be? What if you're 50? Do you still have to ask your parents? What if you're 60, 65? What if your parents are dead? Do you still have to ask them? What if your parents are just unreasonable? I mean, fair enough, if you're 10 and your parents are unreasonable, well, that's what you just have to deal with it, right? You're a kid, right? But if you're 30 or 40 and you want to ordain and your parents are saying, no, you can't ordain because I need somebody to cook my dinner for me or something like that, and I'm not going to let you go, and if they're just being unreasonable, then are you required to stay there, yeah, and not ordain? There was one occasion when someone in England wanted to ordain. I'm just trying to recall the details of the story, but there was an Englishman wanted to ordain, and Ajahn Chah was visiting the English monastery. They were just starting up at the time, and this young man's father, and he was an adult, but his father was very, very angry and upset, Ajahn Chah was talking to him and said, you know what, but you know, your son's an adult, shouldn't he be able to make his choices? And his father said, yes, he can make his choices. And he said, you know, but what if, you know, people, what if he was to choose something, what if he was to choose to be a criminal or something like that? He said, well, that's his choice, I can't control him. And he said, but you're not going to let him become a monk? He says, no. And so he goes away, and Ajahn Chah says, okay, we can go and do the ordination now. And he said, he said he can make his choice, and if he can choose to be a criminal, he said, being a monk's much better than being a criminal, so I think it should be fine. So, you know, this is not something that we should insist on too much. My personal feeling is that most likely, originally, that rule was only meant to apply to children, and it came to apply as a general rule later on. This is a kind of a tendency that we find with the ordination procedures, that you tend to find that specific things which are introduced for specific contexts later on sort of become applied generally. And so the ordination procedure becomes more and more and more complicated and involved, whereas actually originally it was very simple. In fact, the first ordination, the Buddha said, was ehi bhikkhu, kam bhikkhu, right? It doesn't get much simpler than that. Yeah? And gradually things get more and more complicated. This is my suspicion that originally that should apply for young boys. So these days, if to practice that, I would say that certainly if somebody's underage, if they're under 20 or so, they definitely should have their parents' permission. If they're older than that, then I think you just have to look at it on a case-by-case basis. Obviously, it's best if you can have your parents' parents' permission. And, you know, I think to give respect to that and to give care to that, I think, is important. Yeah. There was another case with a young Indian man wanted to ordain, and he wanted to ordain at Wat Nanachat in Thailand, and his parents were very strongly opposed to him ordaining. And he wrote to the monks at Wat Nanachat and asked about ordination and told them his problem with his parents and asked what he should do. And the monk at Wat Nanachat wrote back to him. And the parents were so suspicious, because they knew their son's intention, they were so suspicious, they intercepted the letter and opened it and read it before he had a chance to read it. Yeah? And then the letter wrote back saying giving the advice from the monk, giving advice to the young man, saying that we should always respect our parents, and we should always respect our parents' wishes. And if they love you so much that they don't want to lose you, then this is just because of their care and their loving kindness. So we should always treat that with respect and not do anything that's going to harm them. And so the parents read this, and they were in tears, and they came to see their son crying and apologizing to him and saying, "Oh, we're so sorry, we thought that you were going to do something and run off and sneak away, and we just love you so much, we don't want to lose you, but seeing as these people are such nice people, then we give you our blessing and you can go and ordain." Okay, any more questions? Yeah, the gentleman there. I think this will have to be the last question. We're nearly at the Dana time.
So I know this is got to do with actually the. I got a couple of questions after this on the same material.
Okay, could you speak up a little bit? It's a bit hard to hear.
Yeah. As to Anapanasati Sutta,
yep.
Buddha clearly defined that there are 16 different stages on it,
uh-huh.
inside the sutta itself. So, uh-huh. In the first stage, and he also clearly defined that how you can change from Kayanupassana to Vedanupassana to Chittanupassana to Dhammanupassana. So the first question is in the first bit, in the first four steps, it's about Vitaka, Vichara, Priti, Sukha, and Ekagruta. So now, for me, when you practice on the Vitaka, Vichara stage, now if you let the mind go from Vitaka, Vichara, so that means you stay on that particular the breathing, or you realize that it's actually going out from the breathing. So now, if you let the mind go on other thoughts, and if it's going to run wild, then it's going to disturb the first stage. So, vitaka vichara is like you realize that it's gone out, and then vichara is like you're bringing it back. So, is it a good idea that to let the mind to run wild and let it observe that particular, so like you're actually focusing on the breathing, and suddenly mind goes into a nice lunch. So you can get hang on the nice lunch, and it can keep on going on there, or you just say that ignore the fact and come back to breathing. So the question, first question is, do you force it or you let it come back?
Hello, can I have something? Thank you. The simile that the Buddha used for the breath, he said the breath is like when the wind blows along the path and the leaves are scattered on the path, the wind will blow the leaves and scatter them. In just the same way, when you practice mindfulness of breathing, it will scatter away the five hindrances. Yeah. So this is this idea that I was saying before, that the breath naturally will calm you down. Okay, you don't have to worry about it. Don't worry about chasing the thoughts. Don't worry about all of these technical details and things. None of that is going to help you to find peace in your mind. What finds peace in your mind is by letting go. Or saggaramanam karitva labhati samadhi labhati citta saigagatam. Because based on letting go, one gains samadhi, one gains unification of mind. Yeah. So when we practice that, then yes, there are these signposts and this process of meditation which unfolds through the Anapanasati Sutta. But the Anapanasati Sutta is not meant to be a set of instructions on what to do. Anapanasati Sutta is more like a guide to the landscape that we're going through. When you first sit down to meditate, the breath is a bit longer because your body is still active, your brain is still active, and so on. And then gradually, as you breathe in and out and be peaceful, then the breath will shorten down and become more quiet and shorter. Yeah? Gradually, you have the feeling of that breath is starting to unify and the whole body is coming together and you feel like one thing. Yeah? And this is sabbakaya patisanvedi. And then it all becomes very, very, very tranquil. Yeah? It almost disappears, and the breath almost disappears. And this is the pasambhayan kaya sankara. So gradually, as it goes through this process, you see what the purpose of those steps in Anapanasati is not to rigidly do one and then the other and then the other and then the other. The purpose is that as you're practicing, you can see the unfolding of these things and you can understand, oh, when meditation is going the right way, when it's going the wrong way, and it gives you some guidance and support in your meditation. That's all. Yeah. But the actual cause of all that thing to happening is letting go. Yeah. The very beginning of the Anapanasati, the zero step before digangwa asasisamiti. Before all of those things, it says so sato va asasati, sato pasasati. Yeah? Mindful, one breathes in; mindful, one breathes out. Yeah? That's the basis for everything that happens in Anapanasati.
Yeah, the second question on that, Sana says that if you look at the sutra again, and then if you look at the Priti Sukha Ekagrata, Vitakka Vichara Priti Sukha Ekagrata, so I sometimes, if you don't reach
sorry,
that far.
Sorry, I'm not quite sure. Can I keep this on, please? Hello? Thank you. I'm not quite sure what you're referring to there. There's no mention of those things in the Anapanasati Sutta. Are you referring to something else now?
I'm referring to the whenever you, in the material that Vitakka Vichara, Priti, Sukha, Ekagrata, so different dhyana levels that has been explained in some of the sutras. There are a few sutras that explain that.
Sure, yeah. Okay, fine.
So that's vitakka, vichara, priti.
But no, we're not specific. Are we specifically talking about anapana now or something? Or
no, it's in general.
Okay, another question. Okay, thank
you. So if you use anapana as a meditation technique, to go through the vitakka, vichara, priti, sukha and ekagrata, which Buddha clearly explained.
Is that a question?
No. What I'm trying to say is like, see, if you don't reach some levels like, in the mind, sometimes if you're focusing on breath, and is there any technique that one of the problems I have is like if you pass about 20 minutes, you get a back problem. So the back pain comes up.
Back pain, okay.
Yeah, so that actually supersedes the breathing focus.
Right, okay, yeah.
Is there any technique that you can overcome that? The reason I asked about the vitakka vichara part, if you are in ekagrata, then you don't get any other feelings anyway.
Right,
so
right,
then
right.
If you can jump straight away within 10 minutes from there to the ekagrata, then you have no problem. But the problem is like, I'm not that lucky as yet.
Okay.
So that way that I'm not passing the first step, so because of that reason, my pain can take over in the course of the meditation. So the question is there any way that you know, any other technique that can follow in order to overcome that?
Okay. I don't think there's anything, there's no universal tricks that you can use. I mean, even the Buddha said that it's only in deep, because the Buddha himself had bad back pain. So this is one reflection that you can use. Sadhu, sadhu, I have back pain, just like the Buddha had back pain. Oh, I want the same path. So, and he himself said it's only when he was late in life, only when he was in deep meditation, deep samadhi, that he'd be free from that pain. Yeah? So that's going to be there. I mean, physically you can try with your posture and so on to see if you can improve that. But at the end of the day, we're always going to have some pain and discomfort in our meditation. If the pain's coming, what I usually recommend is you do a twofold approach to the pain, okay? So if you're meditating, you're doing breath meditation or something, let's assume we're doing breath meditation. We just keep watching the breath, there's a bit of pain in the back, we don't worry about it too much, just keep on with the breath, okay? If you come to a point where the back pain is too much and you can't focus on the breath anymore, okay, then put that meditation on the breath aside for a moment. So do that consciously. You say, okay, I can't do this breath meditation now because the pain is too much. I'll put that to one side and then you just come and focus on the pain. I'm just going to be mindful. It's dukkha vedana. I'm going to be mindful of the pain. And you stay there for a few minutes and you just watch that pain. And as you watch the pain, you go into it, then gradually you'll find that it breaks up. And the pain is empty. And the closer you look in there to try to find where is the core of that pain, where is the heart of it, the further it goes away. And the longer you stay there and watch that pain, watch that feeling, you'll find that, actually, there's nothing to it. Right? Sometimes the pain might come, sometimes it might go, but it's not disturbing you so much. So you pay attention to that, you watch it, okay, it's like that. And when you feel that the mind has some equanimity around the pain, like you're not bothered by it so much, then you say, okay, now I can go back and I pick up the anapanasati again, and you take that up and then you keep practicing. And so you can alternate like this. But the important thing is to be clear about what you're doing at that one particular time. If you're watching the breath, you just watch the breath. If you're watching the pain, you just watch the pain. And you be clear in your mind about when you're doing those two things. But just to come back again to the talk about that, developing the five jhana factors through your meditation, the other thing that's relevant there is that if you learn to hurry along a little bit with the piti sukha, right, So if you learn to develop the rapture and the bliss more quickly, then that can help also to cope with the pain, yeah, because that can relieve it. One of the good tricks there is doing metta meditation, because metta tends to bring up the piti sukha much faster than with anapana. Anapana, the tendency is that it gets more tranquil, and you go to quite a deep level of tranquility before the piti sukha arises. Typically, not 100%, but usually that's what happens. Whereas with metta, it's the opposite way around. With metta, you tend to have the piti sukha, the rapture and bliss comes sooner, and then gradually the mind becomes tranquil later on. Yeah? So it's, at the end of the day, it comes to the same place, but takes slightly different avenues towards that. So that's something else you might want to try.
As you mentioned the piti sukha on the metta meditation.
Yeah.
Then metta meditation would not go into ekagrata. Am I right saying that?
No, metta meditation would lead to ekagrata, the same, yeah.
Metta would not go all the way up to the enlightenment. Am I right saying that? Then according to some of the disclosures.
Metta meditation leads to samasamadhi, yeah? Metta cetta vimutti, yeah? Yeah. Yes. Just one, well, it was going to be the last question, but we'll have one more. Go on. Like I said, you can't get you guys to stop once you get started, so...
Venerable sir,
yes.
I have when it comes to metta meditation,
yeah.
I've always been practicing, and you know, I've learned to practice it in a way where you start off from your own self,
uh-huh.
and you know, may I be well and happy, and then move on from there to your parents and your loved ones, and then slowly, gradually move on to the rest of the world. But recently I heard that the only place where Lord Buddha has explained about metta is in the Karaniya Metta Sutta.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Karaniya Metta Sutta there is no mentioning of actually may I be well and happy and may my loved ones be well and happy. It's always talking about may the rest of the world be well and happy, may all sentient beings be well and happy. So I'm a little confused now. Actually, I mean, I think it is a very popular method in Sri Lanka, at least, to always start from yourself and gradually move out from your inner circles onto the outer circles.
Yeah, yeah.
But is it actually a way of promoting me, mine, myself, and that what is actually being discouraged in Buddhism to be to not cling on to me, myself,
no,
and
don't
I?
Don't worry about it. Yeah.
So, is Kalyani Metta Sutta the only place where metta has been explained by Buddha, and is
no.
that the way to actually practice metta meditation without concentrating on yourself?
No, that's not correct to say it's the only place where it's taught. I mean, the most common passage where the metta and the Brahma Viharas is taught, metta sahagatena cetasa, and then it goes through and it says, ekang disang paritwa. Viharati tata dutiyang tata tatiyang tata chututang iti udhamadho diriyang sabbati sabbang sabbatataya, and it has the word in there, sabbatataya, to each as to oneself, yeah, to all as to oneself, sabbatataya. So that actually, that idea of starting from yourself is, I think, is taken from that phrase there, which is actually the most common passage where metta meditation is taught in the suttas, and there are other passages in the Sagatavagga, in the Raja Samyutta, where King Pasenadi is discussing with his wife Queen Malika, and about and this is one of my favourite passages in the suttas, because where Pasenadi says to Malika, "Who do you love most in the world?" Right? Now this is a very loaded question, right? It's a loaded question for any husband to ask his wife. It's especially a loaded question when it's the king, right? So who do you love most in all the world? And Malika thinks about it for a bit and says, actually, I love myself the most in the world. Yeah? And Pasenadi goes, what? How can you say? And she says, you know, this is something that was taught by the Buddha, that we each love ourselves more than anybody else in the world. And King Pasenadi says, oh, that Buddha, everything the Buddha says, you just say, oh, the Buddha said this, the Buddha said that. So it's very psychologically acute. Notice that there's two different things happening here, okay? There's one is, who do we love the best in the world, right? Another question is, who should we love the best in the world? These are two quite separate questions, Yeah? The reality is that we're mostly concerned about ourselves. Right? The ideal is that we're equally concerned with all sentient beings. So the question that the Metta meditation method addresses is, how do we get from the reality to the perfection, to the ideal? Yeah? And so this is where all Buddhist meditations, one of the hallmark of early Buddhist meditations is it's always grounded on some kind of reality, right? Whether it's watching the breath or the parts of the body or the postures of the body or anything like that, you start with what is real and what is true. And so we begin with the reality, which is that we usually love ourselves more than anybody else. We build from there, yeah? Absolutely characteristic of all the Buddhist meditations and everything, the whole Buddhist approach to training is that we start with what's simple and what's easy and we gradually move towards what's more complex and what's more difficult and more advanced. Yeah? So gradually that process of moving. So this is where we start with ourselves, with our family, those that we love. We purify that and perfect that, and little bit by little bit we extend that and grow that until it becomes perfected. Yeah. So also important to remember with these things that meditation methods are just things that are there to help us. Okay? So there's no right way and no wrong way. There's just things that are more or less helpful. So don't worry about that. If there's different methods, there's lots of different methods to meditate. We know that, you know, traditionally they say the Buddha taught 40 different meditations, but actually if we look in the suttas, there's a lot more than that. And so there's not a kind of right way and a wrong way and these kinds of things. But if someone's teaching us a meditation, if you want to practice that, you practice it. And then you see how that goes. If that leads to peace of mind, to happiness, to letting go, to mindfulness, to wisdom, then that's the right meditation for you. Yeah.